From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
This story is for those who don't have a mic or a big mouth, and for those who are in school but don't even know there's a better education out there because they've been in lower classes since they were 11 or 12.
How often do you hear a kid's voice on the radio or on TV? Not in a cartoon or a sitcom, but on the news, reporting something about what it's like to be a kid. Well, there's a growing youth media movement out there. And in this hour, we'll sample some of it. From the problems kids face in overcrowded urban schools to a day in the life of a fourth grade class.
Do you like the lunch they have?
Sometimes. This is all right, but most of the time it tastes really bad.
Vegetarian
chili.
God, that's disgusting.
My least favorite is the chicken patty. I never liked it, and it is disgusting.
Today we're having hot dogs, french fries, peach halves, and a bun.
Life in fourth grade, coming up this hour. Also, Maurice Sendak does Peter and the Wolf for Klezmer. And an unfortunate interview with a miserable author named Lemony Snicket. But first,
Radio Rookies is a program that trains young people how to create radio documentaries about their lives and their communities.
Kari Pitkins, the senior producer of Radio Rookies, New York's award-winning teen public radio project. Her mission is to help teenagers have a voice on the news.
We basically partner with community organizations across New York City and work with small groups of teenagers, about six in a workshop, over the course of about 6 months. We work incredibly intensively. And at the end of the workshop, they produce these amazing radio stories that we then air locally on Morning Edition.
I'm usually doing homework till around midnight because on top of what I get from school, I also get homework from my mom's. I mean, my mother. She'll kill me if I don't speak correctly.
Jimita Haskell was a radio rookie when she was in high school at Curtis High on Staten Island. Jay, we're about to play an excerpt from the piece you did. You want to say what it's about?
My piece was educational tracking. In New York City, we have a tracking system where we put some students in mainstream and then we put them in honor classes or SIS classes.
I have to admit, that really wasn't me when I was in middle school. I had a 75 average. Nah, no good. I was put into mainstream classes where the challenge was focusing on my work while someone hummed a song they were listening to or threw a paper at the teacher or found out what happened on TV last night.
All these kids are being all bad and still getting good grades.
My friend Tashia feels the same way I do.
Like when you're in mainstream classes, like teachers don't care like if you got it or not. Like they only teach people that's in the front or something.
My ninth grade history teacher was different.
When you were teaching me, did you see potential in me?
Almost immediately. You worked very hard. Your hand was always up. You were always on time. Your homework was always in, done well.
I felt that I was doing well in my classes. Too well. But I just figured that this is where I was put, so this is where I should be. I would just graduate at the top of the bottom. To be honest with you, I never thought that I could be in the higher classes, but Mr. Arguelles proved me wrong. He got me into an SIS history class.
I felt that you would benefit from an environment where such work was the norm. I felt that that was necessary for you. That was a better environment for you.
It was a whole other habitat. I got this teacher, Mr. Buxbaum, who could turn your worst subject into your best one. We got brand new books that crackles when you open them and everything. If there was a debate going on, they raise their hands and say, well, I can understand your opinion, but... In mainstream, they'll be shouting about your baby's mother's sister by the time the discussion ends. I was liking Mr. Buxbaum's class, doing my homework, participating, you know. But just as I was getting started, I got kicked out.
Hey, this is Jay. I'm in the front of Curtis High School. I got switched to mainstream. I got different books, which is garbage books. I got a different teacher. I'm not saying that the teacher was garbage, but...
The day I found out I was dropped from the SIS program, I had a why attitude, like, why are you doing this to me? I was mentally sick from the roller coaster. It brought me to the top, where I could see myself going to a good college, then, womp, it dropped me to the bottom, where I could see myself going nowhere.
I think I would be able to be in the SIS program if it wasn't so crowded.
Jay, when you were doing this piece, you went back to the guidance counselor who transferred you, and you asked her why you couldn't be in the more advanced classes. Was that hard to do?
It was very hard. The guidance counselor that I had interviewed wasn't my guidance counselor for the past 2 years, and a lot of people thought that I was interviewing them to get them in trouble. That's why I say in my story, the power of the mic is very powerful because, you know, she straightened up. She realized that the answers to her questions now were going to be recorded. So she was very honest at the time. And the answers that I got were different.
There are ways that you can move from mainstream classes to the higher programs.
They would have to attain at least an 85 average. A cumulative 85 average, and get recommendations from their English teacher, their history teacher, their science teacher, all their academic subjects.
And by accident, I found one more way to get into the advanced program. Because of my mic and my big mouth, my principal, Mr. Cito, found out what happened to me and helped me get into the SIS program permanently this semester. He actually wrote on my class transfer form, "I want this done now." Now, I'm in an SIS homeroom, and in my SIS English class, I understand why Petruchio loves Catherine and William Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew. But this story is for those who don't have a mic or a big mouth, and for those who are in school doing the right thing, but don't even know there's a better education out there because they've been in lower classes since they were 11 or 12. There is something better out there for you. So scream, bring out your parents, be noticeable. You have a chance to succeed. Like me.
Kari, how typical is Jay's experience, what happened to her with Radio Rookies?
I think it's extremely typical that something about reporting these stories, whether it's on something incredibly personal or even something about somebody's neighborhood, there's something about that process of deciding, I'm curious about this, I'm passionate about this, I want to know more, and then following it through. And not only following it through and then walking away with a CD, but you follow it through and suddenly it goes out on the air and tens of thousands of people hear it. Even though that happens in an instant, you know, you spend months and months and then 7 minutes later, your piece is over. There's something about knowing that all those people are sitting in their car or drinking their coffee and hearing this. Once that moment happens, it is pretty incredible to see how many times it can really shift things for a teenager.
You've worked with other kids who have had the same kind of experience, right?
Yeah. It varies, of course, especially with, you know, how scary of a story was it to tell. And I think when it was a really scary story and it took a lot of courage, then the impact can be even bigger. One example is one of our rookies did a story about her father's addiction to heroin. And it's a beautiful piece of radio. And she had to be so brave to go and ask her father some of these questions. And actually, yesterday, we were talking to her about kind of what that story meant to her. And she actually said, you know, before she worked on that piece, you know, she didn't really see herself making it past 18. She couldn't really see beyond that. Something about going to her dad and just asking these incredibly difficult questions, not just for her own sake, but also, as Jay said, on the mic, and then doing something with that really shifted things for her. And now she's, you know, she left New York, she's in Louisiana, she's in college, and she's, you know, she's planning for a future. And I mean, of course, it's hard to know if she hadn't done the story, maybe things would have worked out that way as well, but she credits it a lot.
Does it ever work out that kids, that their peers listen to these pieces and their relationship maybe with their peers changes? Was that true for you, Jay? Did your friends hear your piece?
My best friend heard. She told me that my voice sounded a little funny, but and it's real scary, like allowing people, especially your peers, to listen to your piece, because it's something that's on a different level as them. It's not like you're in a basketball team and they're going to your games, or it's a competition. It's something that people do for a living, and it's something that's on a totally different scale. So when your peers listen to it, it is kind of scary. But the feedback that I had gotten from her was, I never knew that you felt that way. Wow. And then we had a totally discussion about it, because a lot of my friends were angry that I left mainstream because I was in the classes with them. And now I was going into these honor classes, and it was a totally different world because those kids hung out with their friends and mainstream kids hung out with their friends. So when she had listened to my story, she understood how important it was to me.
So it's kind of like a public confession. I mean, this was more honest with your friends than you'd been.
Right. Wow. Right. Exactly.
Kari, these kids producing their own stories is clearly very empowering, but that's not really what Radio Rookies is supposed to be about, is it?
Well, it's a core aspect of the program, but ultimately, you know, our mission, we're a part of a radio station, and we're really about creating great radio. And so the fact that it changes young people's lives is sort of this, like, incredible, I mean, it's like this unbelievable gravy on the whole situation.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily the number one aspect of the meal that we're trying to that we're trying to cook up. So the radio piece is, that's kind of the meat of it. And then afterwards you go, oh, and it changed someone's life. How amazing.
Yeah.
How delightful. But we're really, you know, we're trying to help young people tell their stories, and also voices that you might not hear every day on Morning Edition. And that, I think, is one of the things that the audience really responds to. I think something that I often think about is that when you hear a Rookie's piece, you really get a sense of you're getting inside of a world of a kid that you sat next to on the train and you just didn't know anything about their life, but you have this incredible intimacy.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is so cool about it in a way is that it seems to me a lot of media is aimed at kids, not by kids, I guess. I mean, mm-hmm. This is an opportunity for young people to tell their stories, and that means kind of a reversal of the media process.
There's a lot of really exciting youth media happening around the country and around the world right now. I think there's a big push to kind of acknowledge that media literacy is a really important part of being a citizen in the world right now. And so there are a lot of organizations that have taken that on as a goal, and thankfully, there are a lot of foundations that see it as important. So you're seeing a lot of things kind of crop up all over the place, which is, to me, it's wonderful. I mean, more is more.
Kari Pitkin is the senior producer for Radio Rookies at WNYC in New York. By the way, the Rookies won a Peabody Award this spring. And you may be hearing more from Jamita Haskell in the future. She's currently enrolled at Brooklyn College and is studying radio.
Hi, we're from Miss Minsberg's class at Randall Elementary, and we're in fourth grade. And your day is probably different than ours, so we want to tell you what ours is like.
School starts at 7:45, which I think is really unfair.
Yeah, it should start at like 9 or something.
Yeah.
And then we go into the classroom, and there's about 5 minutes tops before we start school.
And then
like, we do the attendance.
Yeah, we take attendance.
And always right in the middle of the attendance,
the pledge starts.
Yeah. Because the pledge is always late.
Could I have your attention, please? We live in a nation of freedom. Participation in the pledge is voluntary. Those who wish to participate may stand, and others may remain seated.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Have a great Monday.
Hook of strings, first up. The best of you, let's line up for strings.
After the pledge and the attendance and everything, you can have a string. You can have violin, viola, or cello.
Mr. Shrank is really cool.
Yeah,
and
he's really
funny.
Cool.
And he plays for the orchestra.
Okay, boys and girls.
We all pretty much like strings, but we only get 45 minutes one day a week, which I think really stink for the kids that last year got 2 days.
45 minutes isn't enough.
Okay. Boys and girls, very good. Record time. We finished tuning in about 6 minutes. That was pretty fast. Okay, let's start off with a little review today. I'm thinking of a tune. Right?
Yes, sir.
Cucamara. Here we go. two. Ready, go!
We'll check back with Mrs. Mintzberg's class, but first, to the best of our knowledge, producer Charles Monroe Kane recently fell hard for what he thought was a piece of youth media. MTV's hit comedy The Andy Milonakis Show features the antics of what looks and sounds like a prepubescent boy who's been given a video camera and a film crew and told to do whatever he wants.
I rock peas on my head, but don't call me a pea head. Bees on my head, but don't call me a bee head. Bruce Lee's on my head, but don't call me a Lee head. Now please excuse me.
When I first saw The Andy Milonakis Show, MTV's new smash hit, my jaw dropped. Literally. I couldn't believe a show this funny, this original, was anywhere on TV, especially MTV. And get this, it was made by a kid.
I wonder if I got a letter from my pen pal in Alaska. Awesome!
Dearest Andy, today it was 35 degrees below zero. I didn't wake up until 4 p.m. Then I ate 12 ice cube sandwiches. I feel so fat. Right back soon. Freddy.
Dear Freddy, things are going great here in New York. We have heat and we never have to worry about freezing to death. I'm sorry you suck so much, but more importantly, I wish I didn't have to deal with having such a sucky pen pal. Write me back soon. Andy.
Stupid, I know, but here's Andy Milonakis, a chubby, apartment-bound city kid who looks like he's about 12, who's writing, directing, and acting in his own TV show. Sure, it's poorly done homemade videos of him trying to inflate a Twinkie with a bicycle pump, or holding a funeral for a piece of ham, but he's got that goofy grin of a child unself-consciously testing the world around him, and I like that. But the backstory on the internet was even better. Andy was discovered by late-night comedy icon Jimmy Kimmel. The video for a song, The Super Bowl is Gay, is emailed around the world. MTV signs him up. The Andy Milonakis Show is a ratings success. Not bad for a show that has cherubim-faced Andy skipping up the strangers and telling him, "Thanks for not stabbing me."
I really hate myself. Have a nice day.
You hate yourself?
Yeah.
What do you mean you hate yourself?
I don't want to talk about it. Why do you have to always pressure me? Have a nice day.
You too. Thanks for the balloon.
Thank you. I hate me. I have no soul. Have a nice day.
I don't have one either.
Truth arrived one day in the form of a New York Times article. Turns out Andy is not an endearing, though strange, 12-year-old kid making his own show out of playing Battleship and eating Skittles. No, Andy Milonakis was born on January 30th, 1976. He's a 30-year-old man with a congenital growth hormone condition, working with a team of some of MTV's best and brightest. I felt so stupid. Played, suckered, betrayed. Look, I'm a pretty savvy media consumer. How could I have been so dumb as to let the MTV machine fool me again? Later, though, I felt depressed. Here's one more thing I thought might be real that turns out to be fake. And I'm just another step closer to not believing in anything, just like the rest of them, my generation of 30-something cynics. I put Andy's DVD on again and watch some of my old favorites. So, I'm asking myself, is a talking pancake still funny?
Does Pancake Face like syrup? I don't know, let's ask him. Wait, I am him, and I love syrup.
Why does this bother me so much anyway? I mean, who cares if he's 12 or not? I guess I do. I do. In this homogenized, mass-produced country of ours, I feel like I'm always looking for something that's not fake. Aren't we all? I mean, this is America, a land of helpless romantics. Some of us actually believe reality shows aren't fake. The unbending optimism and wishful thinking of America. God bless it. So Andy, I know you're 30, and I don't care. Sing for me.
So yo, I gotta go, it's time for me to rock it. I put bologna in my left pocket. Smear some cream cheese in my gold locket. Cause it's my show, I'm Andy Milonakis. It's my show, I'm Spandy Schmillerschmackis. It's my show.
Charles Monroe Kane is a producer for To the Best of Our Knowledge. Still to come, I'm sorry to inform you, is a dreadful interview with the unhappy author of a truly miserable series of best-selling children's books, Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, and his Baudelaire orphans. Next. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Hi, this is Miss Mintzberg's class reporting again, and we're about to show you a little bit of what recess is like here.
We're at the Randall Playground.
At the kickball field.
It's also used for football.
Ouch! Now we're arguing.
We've got tetherball courts, four square courts, and kind of a football field and a playground and two hills.
It needs some swings, in my opinion.
It definitely needs swings.
And more grass.
Oh, what's that for?
I don't know, for fun.
What's your name?
Brendan.
What are you playing right now?
Four square.
Are you winning?
Okay, we do. Well, you don't exactly win in four square, but there's the toilet flusher, the jack, the king, the queen, and the king. And I'm in the queen square right now. Now I'm in the king's. You get out if you can't get the ball, if it's double bounce, double touch, air mail, which is if you hit it from the air.
First of all, you can get out by not hitting the ball when it gets into your square. And then chicken feet is where you where the ball bounces onto your feet.
We don't do chicken feet here.
Oh.
Because, Mr. Bakken made a whole bunch of rules, and he's a gym teacher, and so and we have to follow those rules. So.
Yeah.
And there, he didn't say anything about chicken feet, so we can't do it.
Yeah. What if you have a big argument? Who decides? The line gets to vote if somebody gets out. And if like, the line is all split up, then it's a redo.
Well, they're disputing if Andrew's out. And I guess they...
Do you like to play foursquare? I love playing foursquare.
So now I'm queen.
Brendan just got out because he was talking to us and therefore wasn't ready.
What? That hurt.
Do you guys know a game named
We call it Cherry Drop because it's we're not allowed to say violence words in school.
And it was originally Cherry Bomb. But we're not allowed to say bomb in school.
What is your name and what are you doing?
My name is Claire and I'm hanging upside down on the monkey bar.
We could sing the flamingo bango song. Okay, should we?
Can we?
Okay. There was a flamingo named Bango. Woo!
Who used to tangle with the mango.
Woo! And then with a little bit of Django.
Play
on the San Diego.
Woo!
So that's what we've been doing basically this recess.
Oh, yeah.
I'm glad those kids are having fun because, well, now we're going to talk about some very unhappy children.
If you like stories about clever and reasonably attractive orphans, suspicious spies, carnivorous leeches, Italian food, and secret organizations, then stay. As I retrace each and every one of the Baudelaire children's woeful steps. My name is Lemony Snicket, and it is my sad duty to document this tale.
That is how the movie and the first book of Lemony Snicket's series of unfortunate events begins. But like an off-key violin concert, the Roman Empire, or food poisoning, all things must come to an end. Or so warns the dust jacket of the 13th and final volume of the Chronicles of the Baudelaire Orphans. It's due out on October 13th, and if it's anything like the preceding 12 volumes, it will shoot immediately to the top of the children's bestseller list. Anne Strangechamp sat down recently with a man responsible for Lemony Snicket, writer Daniel Handler. He told her, as you might expect, that he never intended to write the awful books in the first place.
Yes, it was an editor's suggestion and then persistence. She had read my first novel, The Basic Eight, which is not for young people necessarily, but is about young people. And so the editor asked me if I might be interested in writing something for young people. And I said no. I just thought it was a terrible idea. I thought the sort of stories that occurred to me would be nothing that anyone would ever publish for children. And she kept asking me, and then despite myself, I began to have this idea. But it was a dreadful idea. It was about three orphans and a count who would never leave them alone. And I thought the only thing more interesting than one miserable story would be 13 miserable stories in sequence. And so I called the editor and arranged to meet her in a bar because I thought, well, I'll tell her my idea and she'll tell me it's dreadful. And then at least it won't be too awkward because we'll just be in a bar and we'll finish our drinks and go home. And she said she liked the idea, which only embarrassed me further because I thought it meant she was a lightweight.
or drunk.
Well, precisely. And so I thought, now it's going to be even more embarrassing because the next morning she's going to give me a call and say, I don't know what I was thinking. It was the whiskey sidecars. But instead she called me and said, I still like the idea and I'm stone cold sober sitting at my desk.
One of the things that's so distinctive and immediately enticing about the stories is the way they all begin with the narrator telling you that you couldn't possibly want to read this story. That this will be a dreadful experience and you'd much better put it down and go find something else to read. It sounds like that really came out of your real feelings about the books.
Oh, it absolutely did. I mean, what looks like a sort of shrewd marketing plan now based on reverse psychology was quite upfront. Particularly on the backs of all the books is a letter from Mr. Snicket explaining why you shouldn't read them. And it was only when I was done with The Bad Beginning and the editor said, well, you need to come up with something. I thought you might enjoy coming up with the cover copy, something to write on the back to get people to buy it. And I thought, I have no idea what could possibly lure people other than people who know me personally and want me to succeed. That was the only thing I could, the only angle I could think of. And I took a walk to think about it and went grocery shopping. And when I stopped in one of the pharmaceutical aisles and saw all of the warning labels on poisonous substances, that's when it occurred to me. And I remember that I wrote the first one and I sent it to my editor and I thought, this is, I kept thinking that I was always reaching the threshold of the moment where they would say, you're right, this is a terrible idea. And I was sure she would call me and say, well, thanks for taking a crack at it. That's all wrong. And instead she said, this is great. And I just kept waiting for that moment to arrive when someone would tell me that the gig was up. I thought my editor was crazy. And then I thought, the sort of editorial board that decided to actually publish the books was crazy.
I don't know what the moral in that is, but there's got to be one. Well,
that the world's gone mad. I'm the primary symptom of it.
13 bestsellers later.
I would say that the books just failed to fail. I was sure that they would fail, and they didn't.
Well, one of the best decisions you made was surely to make the Baudelaire children orphans. I mean, I remember talking with a children's book editor once, and I asked her if children's book editors had kind of an ideal platonic book in their mind that would be the perfect book to sell. And she said, yes, we call it Little Orphan Pony in the Storm.
Absolutely.
What is it about orphans, do you think?
Well, I think there's a number of attractive things about orphans that all go hand in hand. I mean, there's the essential existential fantasy of childhood, the first time you grab your mother's hand in a supermarket and it turns out to be the hand of some other mother, hopefully still attached to the body of the mother, and that you have this terrible moment where you're all alone and you begin to think of other circumstances in which you could be alone or a greater length of time in which you're alone. And I think that's just a natural fear. But also from the writer end of it, from the author end, it's so convenient to have the parents out of the way because if you want children to be the heroes of the story, they have to sort of be unsupervised. There's no such thing as a supervised hero. And there are a number of ways in which children's literature does that. They can have the father, you know, need to go off woodcutting all the time, leaving the children alone with the stepmother, or the parents can be too busy and sort of have a latchkey kid experience. But a really easy way is just to kill them off at the beginning.
Children, I'm afraid I must inform you of an extremely unfortunate event. I'm very, very sorry to tell you this, but your parents have perished in a fire that's destroyed your entire home.
If you have ever lost someone very important to you, then you already know how it feels. And if you haven't, you cannot possibly imagine it.
Where do you think your own taste for melodrama and for gothic elements comes from? I mean, how far back can you trace that into your childhood?
I was exposed to opera at a very early age. I was a boy soprano when I was very young, and I was taken to the opera at a very young age. My father was a supernumerary in the opera. My parents actually met at a performance of an opera. I mean, many people have said to me, well, the operatic plots are all well and good for the opera when the music is so melodramatic, but you put them into things that don't have any music at all. But I just always thought that was more interesting.
It is true. It's sort of the exact opposite of the kind of stories we think are appropriate for children. I mean, in an opera, usually, at the beginning, everybody's fine, and by the end, they're all dead.
Yes. It's wonderful. I mean, in an opera, a marriage will crumble and a woman will throw herself down the stairs. You just can't get that kind of entertainment at home, hopefully.
I guess I was wondering whether your books also partly grow out of or are fueled by a kind of dislike of some of the books, at least, that children are given.
I hope so. They certainly sprung from a dislike of children's books. I mean, I think one of the germs of my idea about the Baudelaires was that someone had suggested that I write for children, and I thought, oh, I know exactly the sort of crummy children's book you want from me. It's exactly the kind of crummy children's book I was given all the time. It was exactly the kind of crummy children's book that made me throw books across the room.
Like what?
Well, I don't wish to name any names.
I mean,
names
you have to name names, but I mean,
Johnny
describe
Tremaine, which I always hated.
But what makes a children's book crummy?
I think the fact that a hero is rewarded because of the goodness of his or her deeds and a villain is punished because of the badness of them. The moral that if you behave well, you'll be rewarded. That just doesn't happen in life. And I'm not only talking about the great injustices we can all rattle off, but just by the time you're in kindergarten, you've already seen what some kid will get away with and never be punished for, and how, you know, an adult can come into a room and assess completely incorrectly whatever tiny drama is happening and assess blame and punishment. And you begin to see immediately that whether you're rewarded or punished is a chaotic process that has to do with luck and manipulation and circumstances.
Where did you develop and when did you learn that, in fact, I mean, that different moral sensibility, that good things don't happen to good people? I mean, I read somewhere that your father was a Holocaust, had escaped from the Holocaust. Was that something that permeated your childhood and partly helped develop your own moral vision?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the stories around the family dinner table were often about who got out of Germany in time and who didn't. And certainly how that worked was all a matter of luck and circumstance. It was not because some people were good and kept quiet and minded their table manners that they managed to escape. It was because the Nazis forgot to look under the sofa and didn't think to check the haystack, and that the money turned out to be enough to bribe the right person.
Hmm.
So I think that had the shape of it. And I actually think a Jewish upbringing always has the shape of chance and misfortune, even if you're not hearing stories about your own relatives. You're given the sense that the Jewish people are people who survived just sort of by the skin of their teeth all of the time.
And then there's the humor lacing through it all, too. Because isn't the humor the sort of, I mean, that's the only way to deal with the fact, don't you think, that life is constructed of so many accidents and so many weird, strange chances, and the only way
Absolutely.
To deal with it is to have a sense of humor about it.
Yes. I mean, there's even schools of rabbinical thought that think that a sense of humor is a holy state, and that's why there's so much misfortune, is that God doesn't want to be overly revered. He'd rather sort of be winked at.
We haven't talked at all about your authorial alter ego, Lemony Snicket. You do something that's sort of like your fiction in some ways. When you do your bookstore appearances, you go in the character of Daniel Handler, the handler of Lemony Snicket. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah. Lemony Snicket never quite makes it, and so I'm forced to stutter unconvincing lies in his stead about where he is and about why I'm there instead.
Do people usually understand what you're doing and that you really did write the books, or do some people get confused?
Some people get confused, but what's sort of depressing is children are used to exactly that kind of stuttering, incoherent dishonesty from an adult standing in front of them in a suit, and they're so used to that. It's not clear whether they believe me or not, but they're up for that kind of challenge. They're up for trying to discern what's actually going on behind what the adult is telling them. Mm. It's fascinating to me.
Now that you've finished, well, have you actually finished, written the last word of the last book?
I have indeed. It is locked up with the illustrator who is just finishing the last few pencil marks on the illustrations, and then it will be locked up until October.
And will you miss Lemony Snicket?
I feel confident that Mr. Snicket will return. I don't like to make too many promises. Given the chaos we've been talking about, I could be run over by the proverbial bus tomorrow and then nothing more would happen. But I suspect Mr. Snicket will find other things to be interested in.
Glad to hear it.
Me too. Certain people have said that the world is like a calm pond, and that any time a person does even the smallest thing, it is as if a stone is dropped into the pond, spreading circles of ripples further and further out until the entire world has been changed by one tiny action. If this is true, then the book you are reading now is the perfect thing to drop into a pond. The ripples will spread across the surface of the pond, and the world will change for the better, with one less dreadful story to people read, and one more secret hidden at the bottom of a pond where most people never think of looking. The miserable tale of the Baudelaire orphans will be safe in the pond's murky depths, and you will be happier not to read the grim story I have written, but instead to gaze at the rippling scum that rises to the top of the world.
Daniel Handler, reading from Volume 12 of A Series of Unfortunate Events, which he wrote under the name of Lemony Snicket. The 13th and final installment of the series is due out on October 13th. And now, let's check back with those fourth graders we're following.
One of the things that we do in school is we write a lot of book reports. Like, not every class does it, but these are some of them.
Rowan of Rin is about a kid named Rowan who lives in the town of Rin. In Rin, every child is expected to become
strong and fearless. There are squirrels, otters, hedgehogs, and wolves who inhabit Mistmantle Island. Urchin, a young squirrel.
This story is about a mouse named Despero who was born in a castle. He was born with big ears and his eyes open, which is a bad sign for mice. Despero had a father,
Lester. It's about King Arthur, and it's called Sword of the Rightful King. But I won't tell you anything else, because if you wanted to read it, you could.
I totally love reading. It's my favorite thing to do.
Well, it's not my favorite thing to do, but it's really fun.
It's my favorite thing to do in my pastime. I guess I've had more fun doing other things, but I really like to read.
The kind of book I like to read is good books, not bad books.
A book I really loved was Where the Red Fern Grows. It was probably the saddest book I've ever read, but it was really, really good. It was incredible.
A really good book I read this year was A Little Princess.
Oh, that's really good.
It's really good. I love that book.
I mean, I really, Where the Red Fern Grows isn't my favorite book because all books are really good.
Yeah. Kids from Room 206 at Randall Elementary School in Madison, Wisconsin. Stay with us. We'll talk with children's author and illustrator Maurice Sendak. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
National support for To the Best of Our Knowledge is provided by Powell's Books, an independent bookseller since 1971, presenting powellsbooks.blog, a window to the world of literature, authors, and up-to-date book news on the web at powells.com.
It sounds like Peter and the Wolf, but with a difference. It's the klezmer version, Pincus and the Pig, performed by the Shireen Klezmer Orchestra, and with a story written and narrated by children's book luminary Maurice Sendak. You may think it's a far cry from Where the Wild Things Are to the Yiddish-speaking Pincus, but not so, says Sendak. He told Steve Paulson that the story of Peter and the Wolf has always appealed to him.
I grew up on the Prokofiev piece. Everybody did back in the 30s and 40s. That was the classical piece of music for children. And it just seemed hysterically funny to do it again. I'm very familiar with it because when I was very young, living in Brooklyn with my family, my favorite piece was Peter and the Wolf. So here I am now, getting old, and this comes around again, and they're going to do it klezmered And I'm not an actor, and to have me narrate the thing and then go further and do it in a Eastern Brooklyn Yiddish accent, I don't know. You know, when you get old, you do very strange things.
Did you hear of Wojciech Pincus, how he opened wide the gate and hippity hopped over the sweet warm meadow?
Did you have to work on your Yiddish accent?
No, that's what's so strange. It's like it's always there. When I speak to my sister on the phone or certain relatives, I hear it. It just comes back. It's probably all wrong by now. It's probably exaggerated by now. But it's funny.
Did you have much exposure to Yiddish culture when you were growing up?
Oh, definitely. My parents came from Poland, where they lived a little Jewish shtetl, and they came to America, and they only spoke Yiddish. And that was the house language. And when my grandmother came to stay with us, which she did periodically, she could only speak Yiddish. And I spent a good deal of time with her because I adored her. But at home, of course, I spoke English finally, but interspersed with Yiddish. It's still that way. When I'm very angry, then the Yiddish comes spilling out, although because it's an angry language. Huh. There are very few kindly words in it, which is what I love about it. So vitriolic.
Pinky's grandfather Zeta came out angrily shaking his walking stick at Pinky's schlummel. Are you looking for that schlub, Chaza, to come and clobber you again?
Now, I have to say, there seems to be something rather odd about setting Peter and the Wolf to klezmer music, all done in this, as you say, this Brooklyn Yiddish accent. Tell me about your adaptation. What kind of voice were you after?
Well, I was after, not Zero Bustel. I think maybe my father's voice, because my father had a very heavy accent. And I wanted it to be warm. I wanted it to be funny. I wanted it to be cruel and mocking, all of which would turn into my father's voice. But all the coloring and shading had to do with the vituperativeness of doing it in Yiddish, because the instant turning on an emotion from being okay to just being furious, like a second. Like everything was okay, and my mother would say something, and suddenly my father would smack me across the head. It seemed like the head was the thing to hit back then.
You seem to take a certain delight in the fury that Yiddish evokes.
Yes, I am a Yiddishite. I internally, emotionally, and nervously, I am that kind of person. You know, you grow up, you go to analysis, and you pray you won't turn into any of your parents, and you find out that you've turned into both of your parents. And so such is my case, and my father's short temper, my father's amazing imagination. He would make up words that were hilarious. My brother and I would just faint with laughter. We always thought they were real Yiddish words, but they weren't. He just made them up. And I do the same thing, because you could compound the sounds and make up words, and they're very funny. It's a very funny language.
Then a giant Chaza, big, fat, bristly, and altogether disgusting, jumped out of the forest. Feh! He smelled bad, too.
So what are some of your favorite Yiddish touches in this adaptation of Peter and the Wolf?
Well, just even the pleasure of saying Chaza, a schmutzige Chaza, which is filthy pig, which is what all Jewish children are to their parents. You know, that's the most common thing. It's like my mother always called me Wilde Chaya, which is where wild things comes from, that word. Wilde Chaya is a wild thing. But a Chaya is worse than a thing. It's a dirty thing. It's always colored by dirt, by excess of emotion. And that's where the title of that book came from.
Hmm. So fascinating. Well, I, you know, in terms of music, I guess I think of your association with Mozart and other great classical composers. But so where does does klezmer fit into the picture?
I think I'm just trying to pass. I'm basically a klezmerite, but that's not true. I am an idolater of Mozart, which you know, and Schubert and Haydn and Beethoven. Those are my favorite people. There are some modern composers also, but Mozart really rules my life and consoles me. True, he does, like what people think the church does or belief in some faith does is what Mozart is. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful there is something in this world that I can believe in, hold on to, and never, ever lose faith in.
Now, I've heard that you actually own some letters that Mozart wrote to his own family. Is that right?
Yes, I'm very lucky. I have three of the letters that he wrote, two to his father, and one when he's a little boy to his mother. Oh, another one to his wife on his many journeys. And one, they're beautiful because they look like his score. They look like his music pages looked. His script was exquisite. And, of course, to me, it's like having the Holy Cross or a piece of the Holy Cross. It's quite unbelievable to go home and take out and read his letter and hold the parchment in my hand and see where the red seal was broken, see his father's name, the address. It's sort of like a time machine.
So it's sort of like you're touching, it's not just touching genius.
Yes.
It's touching, I don't know, original inspiration or something like that.
Yeah, this man breathed on this paper. This man held a pen that made the strokes on this paper. This man folded the paper and put a seal on it and put his father's name on it. And that's about as close as you can get to somebody you love.
Now, it seems to me that your children's books, I mean, your classic books that everyone knows, Where the Wild Things Are and In the Night Kitchen, tap into some subconscious part of our brains, some piece of experience that we really can't explain rationally. And I'm wondering if that's the same kind of thing that music does.
Well, yes. I don't know that you might, I don't know, you can't call music irrational. Again, I'm not trying to be facetious, but the music doesn't go through your brain, I don't think. It's visceral. And the best parts of my work have nothing to do with my brain, and I'm so grateful for that. It is a visceral, agitated, primal thing, which I have very little control over, which I have no understanding of, but I'm immensely grateful for, because I am taken over by something. I am taken over by something. I don't know why people call me a children's book artist. You know, I guess you have to be somebody in this world. You have to have a label. You have a label. Everybody has a label. But I don't write for children. I don't know how to do that. I don't have children. I never wanted children. It's something that you are. I was doing children's books when I was a child. I was writing little stories and pinning them together, clipping them together. Why? Who knows? Who knows? And I used to be very curious and I used to be very oppressed with not knowing. But what's great about getting old is you just don't care. You don't give a rap how any of this happens. You're just grateful it keeps happening. So you just, what I call, sit back in the mystery and get comfortable with it and let it go. Mm-hmm. Let it go.
Maurice Sendak, author of the children's classic Where the Wild Things Are, and now Pincus and the Pig, winner of the Parents' Choice Gold Award. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
Poetry break!
We're doing poetry break, and we're going down to the art room.
And poetry break is when you knock on the door and scream poetry break, and then you read a poem that you've either memorized or read.
You don't scream it.
Yeah, you say it, and we are memorizing a poem, so we might mess up, or I might mess up. So, yeah, and we're just about here.
This is
poetry break.
Okay, we're from Miss Mintzberg's room, and I'm Emery.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Indigo.
And we're doing the poem called Maximum Umbrellas. Maximum umbrellas, maximum umbrellas, perfect for on-the-go ladies and fellows. What could be better when you're in the rain, running with luggage, you'll wait for the train?
Are you a musician who carries a bass, a student with books and a clarinet case, a shopper with parcels, a porter with bags, a postal employee whose letter pouch drags?
When you've got your arms full and need some protection from bad weather coming in every direction, Maximum Umbrellas will travel beside you, moving along as they cover and guide you. They widen for wideness and heighten for highness, and can be adjusted by setting the rollers from fast for a jogger to slow for a stroller.
Maximum Umbrellas, Maximum Umbrellas, perfect for on-the-go ladies and fellas.
Woo!
Good job!
Poetry break!
We're going to be reading some poems that tells about what we like to do, where we're from, and who we are.
I am from piles and piles of cat hair in very messy rooms. I am from my grandma's hold my pies and turkey with all my gravy.
I am from diaries filled with stories I lock away. I'm from my grandmother's pumpkin pie.
I am from a caring, loving destiny that flows through the air. I am from a secret not to be told, and from a flower that a bee is getting honey from. I am from a sound of jazz when the trumpet blows slow off the aristocrats.
I am from dirt-covered softball gloves with torn edges and broken in leather.
I am from the hum of the spinning wheels on a skateboard and the quick snap of it ollieing through the air.
I am from risk and never am sure. I am from cuts and bruises and clumsy falls on the ground or graceful slide of the goal.
I am from community, working hard to stay strong. I am from dirty soccer balls to America, from piano recitals to ice rinks smooth as glass. I am from broken promises and tears, from joy to sorrow. That's me.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to buy a copy of this show, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for the Kid Powered Media Hour, number 528A. If you have questions or comments, you can reach us at our website, ttbook.org.
Okay, put your chairs up.
I know.
PRI, Public Radio International.